This is the NPR News Update. It's Minnesota's news on your schedule. It's Thursday, May 29th. I'm John Wanamaker. The former top deputy for Archbishop John Neinstedt has spoken at length for the first time in testimony about the handling of clergy sexual abuse. Attorneys released the deposition of Father Peter Laird yesterday as part of a massive lawsuit that stretches back decades. Madeline Barron reports.
Laird served as Vicar General for Neinstedt from late 2009 to last October. In more than 4 hours of testimony earlier this month, Laird portrayed himself as a leader who'd been trying for years to improve the Archdiocese's handling of clergy sexual abuse. He described the frantic days in late September after an NPR News report showed that Neinstedt, Laird, and other top officials did not warn parishioners of a priest's sexual interest in younger men. That priest later pleaded guilty to sexually abusing two boys. In his videotaped deposition, Laird says he met privately with the Archbishop to advise him on how to respond to the NPR News report.
Among a number of different options that I set forth for Archbishop Neinstedt, I listed as one of those options resignation.
Laird said the Archbishop did not say anything in response. Laird says he resigned a few days later.
Leadership needed to be accountable, and that the first thing is to reestablish trust. I was confident of the work that I did. I think I gave good advice, and we took great steps over the years that I was in my position. But I thought it was essential to signal our accountability and to let a process of fact-finding to go forward.
Laird's characterization of himself is at odds with the account of whistleblower Jennifer Hasselberger, who served as Neinstedt's chancellor for canonical affairs for nearly 5 years. Hasselberger resigned in protest last year. She gave this account of her interactions with Laird in an interview with NPR News last summer.
What I found so frustrating about it is that I would have these conversations and I would tell people that, you know, we had to be concerned and not get any traction. You know, I'd mentioned this to Father Laird, and I can't even count how many times we had these discussions, and I would bring him the files and I'd show him the documents, and he'd always go back to, well, we can't go back and correct all the mistakes that were made in the past.
One of the priests Hasselberger tried to sound the alarm on was Father Curtis Wehmeyer, the priest who's now in prison. The timeline of events in the Wehmeyer case has attracted intense public scrutiny, criminal investigations, and a lawsuit. At issue is whether priests broke a state law that requires clergy to report suspected child sexual abuse within 24 hours, unless the information is part of a confession or similar scenario. Laird's testimony contradicted Neinstedt's version of events. Laird said he told Neinstedt about the allegation right away and kept him informed. He said that when Neinstedt learned the priest was Wehmeyer, the Archbishop replied, "I hope it isn't true." Neinstedt said in his sworn testimony that Laird did not tell him anything and that he learned of the allegation 2 days later from a lawyer at the Archdiocese. A chancery official declined to arrange an interview with Neinstedt to discuss the discrepancies. Laird did not return a call seeking comment. Both depositions were taken as part of a lawsuit brought by a man who says he was sexually abused by a different priest decades earlier. The man claims that the Archdiocese has created a public nuisance by keeping information on abusive priests secret. His lawyer, Mike Finnegan, says the conflicting testimony casts doubt on Neinstedt's leadership.
Father Laird's deposition tells us Archbishop Neinstedt may not have been telling the truth in his deposition, and that alarms us, and it puts kids at risk and makes the community not as safe if he's still, even to this late date, not telling the truth about what happened with Curtis Wehmeyer and with other perpetrators in the Archdiocese.
Laird is the fourth Archdiocese official whose testimony was released in the past 2 months. Victims' attorneys also plan to release a deposition of the former Archbishop, Harry Flynn. A spokesman for the St. Paul Police Department says officers do not plan to review the depositions unless the Ramsey County Attorney's Office requests it. Madeline Barron, Minnesota Public Radio News.
DFL Senator Al Franken and DFL Congressman Colin Peterson are the latest members of Minnesota's congressional delegation to call on VA Secretary Eric Shinseki to resign. Tom Scheck reports.
The calls for Shinseki's resignation came just hours after an inspector general report found systemic problems at VA medical centers across the country. The report found that thousands of veterans never received scheduled appointments, nor were they placed on waiting lists. Franken released a statement saying the report is so troubling that he's come to the conclusion that the Department of Veterans Affairs needs new leadership. Peterson's statement said the best step forward is for the secretary to offer his resignation. Both Peterson and Franken are running for re-election in races that are being watched nationally by both parties. More than half of Minnesota's congressional delegation has called on Shinseki to step down. Other members calling for his ouster include Democrats Tim Walz and Rick Nolan and Republicans John Klein and Michelle Bachmann. Tom Scheck, Minnesota Public Radio News.
A shareholder advisory firm says most members of Target's board deserve to be ousted at the company's annual meeting next month. Institutional Shareholder Services says the members of two key board committees didn't do enough to protect the company and its customers from a massive data breach last year. Minnesota Public Radio's Martin Moylan joined All Things Considered host Tom Cran to discuss this latest development.
So what is this advisory group, and why are they saying this about Target board members?
It's Institutional Shareholder Services. They advise big investors like pension funds about matters that are coming up for a vote by investors. And they have a report out today about Target, and they're saying that 7 of 10 Target board members should have been aware of or more closely monitoring the possibility of theft of sensitive information from the retailer.
And here they're talking about specific board members under fire. Who are they?
The members of the Audit and Corporate Responsibility Committees. ISS says that the folks on those committees should have been on top of this issue, and they say that the data breach revealed that the company was inadequately prepared for the risks of doing business in today's electronic commerce environment. And the responsibility for making sure that it was better prepared was with the members of the Audit and Corporate Responsibility Committees, and they're saying they did not do what they should have done.
Now, what's the likelihood that shareholders will actually follow the recommendation here of this group, ISS?
Well, it seems slim to none. Experts I spoke with said they could not recall any such widespread house cleaning. The thought is that maybe major public employee pension funds and unions and like organizations might go along, but most won't. Analysts and other experts I spoke with used terms like far-fetched, extreme, a warning shot by angry shareholders, but they don't think it's going to fly in the end.
And why is that?
Well, the thinking is shareholders won't see the board, or most shareholders won't see the board, as responsible for the data breach. Lots of companies have suffered data breaches, and their board members and their CEOs did not lose their jobs as a result. Plus, there could be an issue with making sure that the board is fully staffed. If they don't return these members, they'll have to find some alternative candidates.
Now, ISS singled out the former chief information officer at Target as well. And what did they say about her?
Well, that was Beth Jacob. They said questions have been raised about the appropriateness of her background. They said that she did not seem to have sufficient background for the position that she had. They said, according to her biography, it listed no specific data security or information technology experience until she was named senior vice president and CIO in 2008. She's left the company, and in comparison, the new CIO has more than 40 years of experience and is recognized as a leader in information technology, data security, and business operations. So he's more of a heavyweight.
What has Target had to say about this today?
Target issued a statement saying it was an industry leader in data security, and it had made significant investments and received third-party certification of its efforts. But in light of the data breach, it's re-examining everything, including senior management roles and reporting structures, as well as board oversight.
If anything happens here, it's likely to happen at the next annual meeting. When will that play out?
Next month, I believe. So it will be interesting to see whether this resonates with shareholders or falls flat.
That's NPR News reporter Marty Moylan speaking with All Things Considered host Tom Cran. 5 teenagers are facing murder charges for the drug overdose death of another teen in January. Police say they followed the supply chain to an alleged dealer in St. Cloud. They say the case demonstrates how dangerous illicit and synthetic drugs can be. Tim Nelson has more.
One night in January, Tara Fitzgerald and a friend slipped pink squares of paper into their mouths and waited. About 2 hours later, things started to go wrong. According to a criminal complaint filed in Washington County Court in Stillwater today, the 17-year-old Woodbury High School student soon started shaking with muscle spasms. Within hours, she was unresponsive. Before noon that Saturday, she was dead.
We have one deceased young lady who was a high school student, and a number of her friends who were distributing drugs are being held to account for that.
That's Washington County Attorney Pete Orput. He says Fitzgerald's case was different from about a dozen other deadly overdoses in the last year and a half.
The difference from these other drug overdose deaths is, for the first time, when we all teamed up, Woodbury Police, Sheriff's Office, and my prosecutors, we were able to go all the way up the distribution chain to where we believe the source of this was coming from.
Two 17-year-old boys and a 17-year-old girl from Woodbury have been charged in juvenile court and may face trial as adults on third-degree murder and drug charges. Two 19-year-old men also were charged with third-degree murder in Tara Fitzgerald's death. Authorities say they trace the fatal drugs back through text messages and social media, step by step through a series of buys, at least one suspected to have been at Woodbury High School. When one alleged supplier was arrested, police recorded conversations of jail calls between him, his mother, and his girlfriend. He allegedly told both that he'd sold the drugs that killed Fitzgerald. Police tracked that supplier's cell phone to another phone in Sauk Center and set up a sting to buy the supposed LSD from a suspected dealer that used that phone. The criminal complaint against Alexander Clausen says he sold 5 doses of the drug to an undercover buyer in St. Cloud. A search of his home in April found another 305 doses of the drug, according to the court file. The drug found in Fitzgerald's body wasn't LSD, but a synthetic hallucinogen known as 25-INBOME. The Federal Drug Enforcement Administration says it has no legal use and that authorities have linked the drug to at least 19 recent deaths in the U.S. Woodbury Police Chief Lee Vague said today he doubted Fitzgerald or her friends knew what they were taking.
You're buying this piece of paper with something on it, and somebody tells you it's LSD or whatever it is, there's no way you can know that. There's no way you can know how much is on it. There's no way you can know where this was sourced from. It's just incredibly, incredibly dangerous behavior. And it seems to me, as we were doing this investigation, there was a very casual attitude amongst young people that this was safe.
People who knew Tara said her mistake and her death were devastating. She played for Woodbury softball coach Bill Hedall and was a friend of his daughter.
She was a very eclectic girl with quite a few different interests and great musical talent and acting, and Tara always got good grades.
She would have finished her junior year of high school next week. Tim Nelson, Minnesota Public Radio News, Stillwater.
As planners of the Southwest Light Rail Project try to win over the Minneapolis City Council, they're facing a new hurdle with the city's park board. Laura Ewan has more.
The Park Board passed a resolution last week saying it would withhold its support for the already embattled Southwest LRT. The commissioners are asking the Metropolitan Council to provide more study into a plan that would send the passenger trains through a tunnel beneath a water channel popular with bicyclists and kayakers. Current plans call for taking the trains over the Kenilworth Channel along a bridge. Park Board President Liz Walensky says it's her duty to protect that sliver of land over the channel.
It's a tiny little bridge in an incredibly scenic portion of the city. If you walk down there, you can see just how special that area is.
In a statement to NPR News, the Met Council says it plans to work with the Park Board to resolve its concerns at the appropriate time. Laura Ewan, Minnesota Public Radio News.
This is the NPR News Update. We come your way every day around noon. It's Minnesota's news on your schedule. The case of a troubled St. Paul charter school is fueling concern among charter critics and supporters alike that the state has little power to fix problems at charter schools. Community Schools of Excellence has faced numerous allegations of mismanagement over the past year. State education officials and the school's authorizers say they're doing everything they can under the law to deal with the problems. But as Tim Post reports, at least one former Minnesota lawmaker is calling for the state to take tighter rein of charters and their overseers.
This spring, Concordia University, the authorizer of Community School of Excellence, asked the school's board to shake things up. Lon Malley is chair of the Charter School Advisory Council at Concordia.
In fact, we said we think it would serve the school best if there was a change in the leadership of the school.
Concordia, which acts as the charter's overseer, made the move after an independent investigation found that Superintendent Mo Chang, the school's founder, had misused federally subsidized lunch funds, discouraged employees from reporting suspected cases of child abuse to authorities, and created a culture of fear among employees. Despite the authorizer's request, the school board refused to remove Chang as leader, citing improvements at the school. Malley says the two sides have agreed to end their relationship, albeit 2 years down the road.
They said to us, why don't we agree to disagree, and when our contract expires in June of 2016, why don't we just go separate ways?
Malley says an authorizer can cancel a charter's contract, essentially closing the school immediately. He says that's not something Concordia wants to do. In an email to NPR News, Chang said she takes concerns about her school seriously. She says they've adjusted their procedures, and she's confident the school is on the right path. The situation at Community School of Excellence follows years of concern among charter critics and supporters, namely, when there are problems in Minnesota's 150 charter schools, who's accountable? In 2009, lawmakers tinkered with state law, changing so-called charter sponsors to authorizers and making them more accountable for the financial and academic affairs of their schools. But in most cases, even if there has been wrongdoing, it's up to the school board, not the authorizer, to make changes. And the state's role is to oversee the authorizer. Officials at the State Department of Education recently asked Concordia to lay out its oversight strategy for the Community School of Excellence and explain why it's no longer pressing for new leadership. The department's assistant commissioner is Kevin McHenry.
What we want to hear from them is, you've raised these concerns. What are you doing to address those to ensure a high-quality school and a high-quality education?
McHenry says the state will have a new system for regularly evaluating authorizers next school year. But one former Minnesota lawmaker doesn't think that's going to be enough. Kathy Saltzman, who served as a DFL state senator from 2007 to 2010, is now state director for the education reform group Students First. Saltzman's group generally supports charters, but proposed legislation this session prompted by the ongoing issues at Community School of Excellence. The bill, which didn't get a committee hearing during the session, would require the state to take action if it has concerns about a charter school.
And so here we have a situation where I think we can do a better job. I think in doing that, we will serve children better, students better, the public better. So that's the challenge before us.
Saltzman says her group will push the issue of charter oversight again next legislative session. DFL State Senator Patricia Torres-Ray, who leads an education committee at the Capitol, says charter accountability will likely be a part of next year's agenda.
I'm thinking that I need to pay very close attention and that next year I have to give that issue a top priority.
Charter school supporters say before lawmakers make any big changes to charter law, they should wait to see how the new authorizer evaluation system works out. Tim Post, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Law enforcement officials are increasingly using social media to catch and prosecute criminal suspects. Those suspects can make it easy for police when they post pictures of themselves breaking the law. Brad Williams reports.
Last December, police arrested a suspected gang member at an alleged stash house for drugs and guns in North Minneapolis. 28-year-old Lamont Charles McGee is also a rapper known as Mo Man. According to the charges filed against him, McGee is a member of a violent street gang called the 19 Block Dipset. Police accused McGee and others of stockpiling guns and ammunition to retaliate for the death of fellow gang member Tyrone Washington, who was shot and killed at the Epic Nightclub last November. Police say McGee, as Mo Man, posted this song called Fuck Crack on SoundCloud a few weeks after Washington's death. Police believe McGee used the song to threaten vengeance against whoever shot Washington, whose street name was Crack. McGee was already headed to prison for illegally possessing guns, so the Hennepin County Attorney's Office declined to prosecute him. However, Hennepin County Attorney Mike Freeman says the use of music, video, and pictures posted online has become more common in criminal prosecutions. He says photos are especially helpful in prosecuting felons or other people legally barred from possessing guns.
When you're talking about prohibited persons and felons in possession, that, we do get some solid convictions of people putting pictures of themselves with a gun up on Facebook.
Those kinds of photos also played a role in federal indictments filed 2 weeks ago in an alleged conspiracy to provide guns to gang members. According to court documents, one of the men charged in the conspiracy, 21-year-old Raheem Watkins, posted a picture of himself holding two guns on Instagram. And those incriminating pictures and videos aren't just posted online by suspected offenders. Last month, a bystander recorded video of two teenage girls beating and robbing another girl near Roosevelt High School in Minneapolis.
Another kid that saw it on social media brought it to one of our school resource officers and says, "Hey, did you see this?"
Minneapolis Police Commander Bruce Fulkins said the video helped officers identify the suspects and make arrests. The girls, ages 14 and 16, were charged with aggravated robbery. But just because something is posted online doesn't mean police can automatically use it as evidence. Fulkins says investigators often have to make a case to a judge before getting their hands on pictures and video.
And we go and bring our information to a judge or a magistrate and ask permission from the courts through a search warrant or a court order to say, can we look at this stuff and can we get copies of it?
When investigators want user information or access to material on Facebook, they have to send warrants to the company's law enforcement compliance department in Palo Alto, California. Facebook isn't the only social media site police are watching. There are other sites out there like Foursquare, Pinterest, and Snapchat, to name a few. And Fulkins, who's been on the force for 26 years, says it's hard for him to keep up.
When we hire young patrol officers, they're sometimes our best source because they're much more in tune than somebody like myself who's been around a long time, and technology is slowly running away from me.
Sometimes investigators don't need a warrant to get online material. Criminal defense attorney Fred Getz says he's seen cases where law enforcement officers get informants who are part of a suspect's circle of friends to give them the material voluntarily. He says that makes it fair game.
Well, I think one could argue either way that if you have privacy settings, you don't need to share it with the general public. But on the other hand, if you have 300, 400, 500 friends, is that really private data anymore that would require the Fourth Amendment protection?
Getz says evidence gathered from social media sites can make prosecutors' cases hard to beat.
Oftentimes the strongest evidence against a defendant are the defendant's own words and actions.
Some civil libertarians say while this practice by law enforcement is legal, it does raise broader questions about privacy. The head of the Minnesota chapter of the ACLU, Chuck Samuelson, says Americans need to ask themselves if it should be legal for police and other government officials to spy on them through the material they post online. Brant Williams, Minnesota Public Radio News, Minneapolis.
And finally, hundreds of farmers in our region are collecting data about their fields with drones this year, hoping the information will make their farm operations more productive. They're embracing drones even as the rules regulating their use remain unclear. Dan Gunderson reports.
A tractor rumbles across a farm field 30 miles west of Fargo as Ross Erickson prepares to use a new piece of farm equipment. It's a 3-pound drone aircraft. Erickson is a college student working for a farmer this summer, photographing farm fields using the drone with a 3-foot wingspan and two cameras mounted in its belly.
Once you get experience with it, it only takes about 5 to 10 minutes to do the setup. It's a pretty simple process.
Erickson throws the drone into the air, and it starts to fly a preset pattern over the field. From a distance, it looks like a hawk floating on a summer updraft. The flight is entirely automated. The drone gets instructions from a laptop perched on the tailgate of Erickson's pickup truck as it cruises 400 feet above the field at about 30 miles per hour. This isn't a toy. The drone and cameras cost landowner and farmer Chris Paulson about $25,000, but he expects the investment to quickly pay off in improved efficiency. The FAA says it's illegal to fly drones for commercial use. Paulson thinks his use is legal because he's flying over his own property. In addition to farming, Paulson is a distributor for a Mankato company, Farm Intelligence, that analyzes the data collected by drones. And while the drones get all the attention, it's the data they harvest that excites farmers.
this is going to revolutionize the way that farmers do business. And the information age is here, and I think it's here to stay, so I really hope guys adapt it and adapt it quickly.
Since there's no registration for small drones, no one tracks how many are in use. But North Dakota State University professor John Nowatzky says drone use is exploding this year.
In North Dakota and Minnesota, there are hundreds of farmers' fields that are being flown in 2014 with unmanned aircraft. And they're being flown, in a commercial basis, so it's certainly not under the rules of FAA.
Nowatzky says in some cases, farmers are flying their own small drones. But there are also businesses flying drones for hire. It's likely both are illegal under the FAA rules. The small aircraft take high-resolution photos and infrared photos. Nowatzky says there can be hundreds of photos from one field. All that data needs to be transferred to a computer server for analysis.
Transferring the data is a big issue. I've spent an hour and a half just uploading data from one field to the Internet.
Farmers will fly their field several times a year. Chris Paulson says he plans 5 to 7 flights over his land. Flying before crops are planted allows him to map wet areas or spot plugged drain tile buried under the field. When the corn in this field is about 3 inches tall, he'll fly it again. When the photos are analyzed, the computer will tell him how many plants per acre sprouted and pinpoint any thin spots. That data can help a farmer better manage fertilizer application, saving money and perhaps increasing yield. Later in the season, the unmanned aerial vehicle, or UAV, will help find weedy spots and analyze the size of corn cobs across the field, giving a preview of crop yield.
It's helping us make better decisions in real time, so I just view a UAV as another tool that should be sitting in your shed somewhere that comes out when it's the appropriate time to help maximize your farming productivity.
But the benefits of drones on the farm are still developing, says NDSU professor John Nowatzky. He's working on research this summer using infrared photographs for early detection of insects or crop disease.
We'll be able to pick up those disease symptoms before a person walking in the field could pick them up with an infrared image, for example. Be able to see the damage before you'd see it with your eyes.
That means farmers can respond more quickly and reduce the amount of crop lost to disease or pest.
That's it right there, and it's going to land right in front of the pickup.
About an hour and 15 minutes after it was launched, Chris Paulson's drone plops into the dirt a few yards from his pickup truck, carrying hundreds of photographs that might well change the way Paulson farms this piece of land. Dan Gunderson, Minnesota Public Radio News, Lynchburg, North Dakota.
And that's the NPR News update for Thursday, May 29th. I'm John Wanamaker. Thanks for listening.